Welcome everyone to the Stoa Nova Conversations. My name is Massimo Pilucci. I'm a professor of philosophy at the City College of New York. And with me is my co-host, Rob Coulter from the University of Wyoming. Hi, Rob, how are you?
Hi, Massimo. Glad to be here today again.
So we'll introduce our guest and topic for today in a minute. Before we do that, I'm going to announce the next meeting, the next episode of the Stoa Nova Conversations. That will take place on February 14th. And you know what day that is? That's going to be at 1 p.m. Eastern time. It's a Sunday. And therefore, we kind of have to talk about Stoicism and love. So tune in on February 14th, Valentine's Day, and we'll tell you everything there is to know about Stoicism and love, which can be very little or maybe a lot. I don't know. It's going to be
an
interesting
conversation.
If you want to register for that event, go to meetup.com and look for Stoa Nova. And if you wish to watch past episodes, including this one, once it's going to be edited and uploaded of the Stoa Nova Conversations, then go to my YouTube channel and you know, look under my name and look for the Stoa Nova playlist. So today's topic is the ethics of the family in Seneca. And so we're going to talk about Seneca, about the family, and our guest is Liz Gloin, who has actually written a book, and not at all coincidentally, by the same title. And Liz is lecturer in classics at Royal Holloway, University of London, as well as Latin literature and Roman philosophy. Her research interests also include the history of women as professional classicists and the role of classic monsters in modern popular culture. Welcome, Liz. Thanks for
being
here. Hi,
lovely to be here.
All right, Rob, you want to get it going?
Yeah, sure, I'll get it going. So Liz, again, great to meet you. So glad you could join us today to talk about this book. And I confess, I think I have a new favorite book on Seneca, so thank you very much.
Oh, bless you. Thank you. It's very kind of you to say.
Yeah, it was really wonderful. Got me thinking a lot. And I learned some things too. So it seems to me that sort of three big things kind of drive your account in the book: the family, obviously, but also the Stoic notions of oikeosis and of cosmopolitanism. So I'd like to sort of see if we can set up those ideas to sort of frame our conversation a little bit. And I'd like to start with oikeosis if we can, right? So I wonder if you could explain a little bit about oikeosis. And how you take it to be central to these questions about the family and growth and virtue, and maybe in particular how it informs your account of the relationships between mother and child we see in the consolations to Marcia and Helvia.
Yeah, absolutely. So first thing to say is that there are two types of oikeosis in Stoicism. They're clearly related. It's just really, really irritating that none of the sources that explain precisely how they're related have survived. So we can see there's a link. There are two types: are personal oikeosis and social oikeosis. Personal oikeosis is the stuff that we see with babies all the time. It's the point when they suddenly realize that that pink thing going across their gaze actually is their arm. You know, so when they suddenly realize that this thing that they've sort of, and you see babies go through sort of a developmental phase where they actually do suddenly go, crud, if I move there, it comes back. Gosh. So it clearly is sort of a psychological stage of development. Now, social oikeosis is essentially the same process of realizing stuff that belongs to you, that you have an interest in these things, except not actually your own physical body parts, but sort of the social structures around us. So you can see kind of how those two things relate together, but unfortunately, the precise logic, we don't have anything that actually lays it out, which is really irritating, but you can kind of see how they grow on each other. And the source I think that explains how social oikeosis works best is from a Stoic called Hierocles. And he describes it, it's the one illustration in my book, is the picture I did of this on Word, using the Word diagram function, which has now been published in a book by Cambridge University Press, which is hilarious. But the idea is that there's a series of concentric circles. So in the innermost circle, the one right in the middle, is you. And just you, the self, and that's everything that's in that middle circle. And that's when you only think about yourself, you. Now, the next circle out, so we have, as I say, this series of circles getting bigger and bigger and bigger. The next circle out are your close relations. So your parents, your brothers and sisters, and also your spouse. So these are the people who are one step away from you. And then as you sort of go further out, you get more distant family. So you get cousins and aunts and uncles and that kind of stuff. And then in the way Hierocles talks about it, because obviously he's using ancient social structures, you get people who are in the same clan as you, people who live in the same town, and then so on and so on and so on, until ultimately the biggest circle, everybody in the universe at all is included within it. And the idea is that as you proceed through the process of oikiosis, you start bringing those circles together. You start breaking down the boundaries between those circles. So you don't see, for instance, the interests of everybody in the world as being totally alien to you. It's got nothing to do with you at all. You don't see the interests of the people in your same city as being totally alien to you. So you sort of start by taking that one step out of your tiny inner circle, where you start to see the interests of those very close family members as the same as yours. That doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to get anything out of it. It's not the same as saying that if you assimilate those interests, that means that you're doing that because it's in your interests to do so, that very utilitarian, I'm on board with this because I'm going to benefit. But you see it as your own interest that these people flourish, whatever that means, even if perhaps that means that you maybe don't do as well out of it as you might have done, because that means more flourishing, better quality of life, better opportunity of achieving virtue for sort of everybody in that circle. The reason the family is really critical to this is because they talk about the assimilation, the process of oikiosis, as being best illustrated by the way that a mother will look after her child's interests. So that first step, that step of I am able to think about another being's interests as being not my own. Think about another being whose interests are not necessarily in my interest. I am able to prioritize that person's well-being. I think any of us who have ever been up with babies who are sleepless at night and sort of, you know, attempting to comfort a small child kind of understand that, right? It's that maybe I don't personally get anything out of that. I don't get to sleep. I end up with sleep deprivation for 6 months. But my small person needs that kind of care in order to develop and be looked after and be sort of socially grounded, right? So the Stoics sort of looked at the way that animal mothers, because the Stoics, as I'm assuming everyone on here in the Zoom room is familiar with, they looked to nature for models, nature the best way of doing things. And they say, well, look, animal mothers do this. Animal mothers who haven't got any grasp of reason at all will jump through hoops of fire if it will keep their baby safe, where there's absolutely no reason for them to do that. So clearly there is something about looking after the best interests of your offspring, even if it's not in your own best interests, that is ground up in following nature, in what the best way of doing things is. So that first step beyond just seeing yourself as the most important person in the universe and starting to expand that range is that step towards your close family. And of course, once you've done the close family thing, when you're able to think about your close family in that way, you sort of stretch it. You stretch it to your closer family, and then you stretch it again, and you stretch it again. So you bring more and more people into that circle of people whose interests are my interests. And by the time you get to the Stoic sage, so the idealized perfect figure who obviously has achieved perfect reason, the idea is that they have incorporated everybody into that circle. The people who sort of think about this sort of are now sort of saying, if we're in a contemporary, you know, if we're thinking about this in a modern kind of sense, we'd also like to add actually that we extend that beyond humans. And we start thinking about the well-being of animals as well, you know, as the next set out, you know, that this isn't actually sort of an anthropocentric model, or that you've kind of got to work through humans before you get beyond first. But all of that can't start if you can't get past that first step.
Right. So in a sense, interpreted let's say, in modern scientific terms, that I think would go well with the Stoic take on things. Can we say that human beings as a species of primate are naturally pro-social? We're naturally cooperative pro-social. We have these instincts, as you say, like other animals. We don't have to think about having, you know, treating our parents well, or our parents don't have to think about treating their children well. And that gives us what Seneca sometimes referred to as the beginning of wisdom, as the rudiments of wisdom, and then, or virtue. And then once the age of reason kicks in and we start actually being able to think in terms of more abstract terms, then we are the ones that actually extrapolate that to broader and broader circles. And as you say, these days, even beyond the human cosmopolis. Does that make sense from a that point of view?
Yes, I think that makes absolute sense from that point of view. And the question of the age of reason, the point at which you're actually able to think rationally. Again, this is one of the things where sort of we wish we had more Stoic evidence. Anything dealing with the ancient world, it's like more text. But we don't actually know precisely when the Stoics think that humans become rational. Our evidence for that we can tell that babies aren't. We can tell that smallish children aren't. But at what point rationality kicks in, we don't have any evidence for precisely where they say it. I mean, they sort of clearly think you're rational by about your 20s.
You know, I've thought about that for a while. Again, from a point of view of a modern scientific evidence, you know, I'm a biologist. So I'm interested in these things also from the modern perspective. They were not that far from the mark. The most recent research, obviously they arrived at that by intuition and by, you know, sort of informal observation of human behavior. We today have sort of quantitative data, brain scans and all that sort of stuff. But as it turns out, modern neuroscience tells us that human brain development is complete around your early 20s, you know, give or take. So that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, I think I actually wonder, given the Roman notion of this, because the Romans had this very, very rough model of life courses, life cycles, life stages happening in 7-year blocks. Mm-hmm. But up to about the age of, and they mark this actually really interestingly. And again, thinking about this, obviously, because there's a 5-year-old in the house. They sort of think about kids up until their 7th birthdays are called infantes, meaning non-speaking, literally do not speak. Obviously, anyone who's met a child under the age of 7 will appreciate that's not true. But the idea was that they weren't sort of capable of a certain kind of logical thought. And at that point, they didn't sort of start formal education until between 7 and 14. And then 14 is the point where they come into what's the humanist status, so the young man status. And 21, they suddenly become a weir, they become grown up again. And part of me wonders whether the way that Seneca is thinking about this is that grasp of rationality is happening at that point where you move into the humanist stage, roughly around 14, 15, 16, different family. It's a flexible point. It's not like illegal. There are no laws that stipulate this, unlike sort of the laws where you sort of say when you can drink, when you can drive, that kind of thing. It's a sort of an informal social thing that depends on an individual child. But there does seem to be sort of that sort of 14, 15, 16 is an age where sort of you're transitioning up. And I wonder whether Seneca would have sort of said, well, actually, that's kind of, you know, everyone will come into it at their own pace. But kind of by the stage you get to, about your 18, 19, 20s, you've definitely got it by then. Yeah. So, you know, it's that kind of gradual development as well. Is something I think they'd be quite comfortable with, in a way that when we think about sort of coming of age in our society, where it is very clearly legally demarcated, you know, that feels a bit less natural just because of the way we've constructed that as a thing.
Great. I think we could talk about that for a while, maybe. we'll get back to it. So maybe we could introduce the other idea, which is, I think, pretty clearly related, but the idea of cosmopolitanism. And, you know, you sort of seem to bring it up most sort of forcefully and explicitly in the account of brotherhood that we start to get in the Ad Polybium. And I wonder if you could expand on that idea of cosmopolitanism and how it affects Seneca's conception of the family.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, cosmopolitanism is something that's quite, again, because we've got the sources we've got, is one of those things that can be quite easily misunderstood and misinterpreted. There was a line of thought very much driven by contemporary notions of civics, that the idea of cosmopolitanism was that only sages, only people who had achieved perfect virtue were members of the cosmic city. And the idea was that the cosmic city sort of applies to everybody who meets the entrance criteria, which in this case was perfect wisdom, which given that the Stoic sage is rarer than a phoenix, quite a small city. Not much in terms of sort of civic bills there. However, as people have sort of come back to this and looked at it a little bit more in terms of what the sources actually say and what ancient notions of citizenship were like, what they actually say is that everybody is a member of the cosmic city, but only those who have complete reason are its citizens. And that sounds really weird until you remember that the ancient world is totally happy with having cities with sort of 50, 60% of people living in them who aren't actually citizen status. Ancient Athens, totally cool with women not having citizen status, and metics, who might be people who just don't live in the city. Who a metic is, a foreigner, which is basically anybody who doesn't meet Athenian citizenship criteria, which is having two Athenian-born parents, right? That is how limited an Athenian sense of citizenship is, where all these ideas are being sort of first generated and thought about. Enslaved people, clearly not citizens, but members of the city. So that's sort of a very different sense of citizenship. So there's a distinction there, as I say, between citizenship, which in the ancient world was a very limited category, and membership or inhabitation of, which was much broader. So the idea of everybody being a member of, an inhabitant of the cosmic city, basically, again, is coming back to the idea that we're all, you know, the biggest circle of oikiosis, right? We're all members of the same cosmic city. We're all linked together in that kind of sense. And the idea that we're all therefore linked to each other as a shared unit, as it were. There's a sort of a shared sense of obligation. Now, brotherhood is an interesting one, because the Consolation to Polybius, for those of you who are not familiar with it, it's a really interesting text, is written to one of Claudius's freedmen called Polybius, whose brother has just died. Seneca is in exile. He was sent into exile on a charge of adultery with Caligula's sister. I tell this to my undergraduates and they go, "Seneca? Seneca was charged. Seneca did something that interesting." It's like, yes, my dears. The ancient Romans I make you read did have interesting private lives. But he was exiled on a ship. Whether it was true or not, we don't know. But he was clearly close enough to the imperial family for that to be a charge that had enough glue to stick, had enough mud to stick in it, right? So he was sent into exile. And while in exile, he wrote this text to Polybius on the death of his brother. To sort of console him. This isn't weird, I hasten to add. There is an ancient consolationary tradition. You write things to people when they're sad. Seneca, as we know, has also done those to Marcia and to his own mother earlier. So he's not sort of doing something that's sort of inappropriate or weird by doing this, which is just worth flagging up. But what he does do, I think, is he sort of uses that brotherhood metaphor to talk about how Polybius has responsibility to his brothers who are still living, his biological brothers, but also to bring in the idea of Seneca as Polybius's brother in the Cosmopolis. So there's kind of a link there through their shared virtue of reason, through their shared rationality, and trying to sort of say, did you remember that your poor brother here, me who is writing, I'm in exile, and it's a bit rubbish in exile, actually. It'd be quite nice to be forgiven and come back. actually. Do you think we can manage that, really? It's all quite subtly done. But it uses that rhetoric of the brotherhood, the cosmopolis. It also, really interestingly, uses the rhetoric of reason. Because, as I'm sure you all know, the Stoic sage is supposed to be happy wherever he is, right? Under whatever circumstances. There's nothing... Now, first of all, Seneca would be the last person on the earth to claim he was a Stoic sage. Right. So just because that might be aspirational for the sage doesn't mean that's actually going to happen. But the other thing he makes the call of is he makes it really clear right at the end of the Consolation, in the last sort of closing paragraphs, as it were, that he is feeling his mind going in exile. That, you know, he's sorry he's written something that's so rubbish, but he's just finding it really hard to string words together. He's not able to think. And it's like, well, that's the only possible thing that as a Stoic, from a Stoic principled position, he's able to say that he should be able to come back from exile. Because obviously you're supposed to, as a Stoic, you're supposed to use your reason. You're supposed to be engaging with your reason. That's what makes you. So therefore, if you're somewhere that's actually negatively affecting your reason, that is probably the only thing that is actually a sustainable Stoic objection to exile, in that it's actually harming your rationality. Which I think is really clever.
Yeah, but, it was really clever.
But he sort of places that that argument alongside the, as my brother in the cosmopolis, you've got a duty to look after me as well. Mm-hmm. And therefore your duty to me is to support me in virtue, because that's what families do. Support me in progressing towards my virtue. And if you're going to do that, then you kind of have to take me out of this rubbish position where I'm not able to use my virtue because my brain is crumbling through my ears because all of these people who refuse to speak proper Latin.
That's right. All these barbarians, they are. Yes, that's right.
Exactly. These barbarians, they don't know how to think. They don't know. It's great because he describes them using like words that you normally use to talk about, like collapsing, rushing waterfalls and all these kinds of words about sort of these verbs using sort of natural imagery verbs. And it's like, I'm fairly sure they did actually say sentences, my love.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, we should also remember that, you know, if you say to somebody, I'm going to send you an exile into Corsica, I would say, oh yeah, sure. it's a great place. It's a resort, island. But at the time, it was a little rough. It was a little on the rough side of things. But I wanted to ask you a question about cosmopolitanism, and in particular, the reception of the idea, even in more recent times. I noticed this pattern that whenever I write about Stoic cosmopolitanism, I get a lot of pushback from people. And we have even major public philosophers like Martha Nussbaum, for instance, who is fairly skeptical of the notion of cosmopolitanism, although there are exceptions like Anthony Appiah, for instance, just wrote a book in defense of cosmopolitanism. But there is a lot of skepticism about this idea, which I personally find strange, because not only I find the idea very appealing, but that's actually one of the major reasons I'm attracted to Stoicism, this notion of you know, well, brothers and sisters planet-wide, and that ought to be a good thing. But it's apparently not for so many people. Do you have a sense of why that might be, or have you encountered similar kind of reaction?
I mean, obviously, I've sort of seen the stuff that Martha Nussbaum and sort of similar philosophers have said in attempting to sort of break down Stoicism cosmopolitanism as a manageable ideal. I mean, I think, to be frank, people probably just feel it's very difficult because it is so idealistic. And I think there is something about the idealism of saying this is where we are and we kind of are all working towards this. I think you have to be sort of quite happy with the idea, which I think actually Stoicism invites us to be anyway, that one can strive for perfection and not reach it, and the striving is still worth doing.
Right.
That, you know, just because, you know, we may never get there. We may never get to that blessed state where, you know, there is that kind of universal empathy universally amongst all every human being, that means it's a flawed idea. And I think sort of some quite rational takes on, you know, this just doesn't work, kind of miss that very aspirational, you know, the whole figure of the Stoic sage, if you look at it, I'm actually reading with my undergraduate students Seneca's On Shortness of Life at the moment, in our Upper Latin class. And they are quite, they took quite a while to get their heads around the fact that the sage is an aspirational figure. Mm-hmm. That is, yeah. He's not being, you know, he's not used to beat you over the head with and tell you that if you aren't doing this, you are an appalling human. You know, that he's much more about an encouraging and a, this is the signpost and this is where we're going. And, you know, this is what can be achieved and this is what we're hoping for. As opposed to feeling that if you haven't done this, then you are a complete failure. And obviously, if we're thinking about certain kinds of stoicism, the much more rigid stoicism sort of found very early
right.
in Stoic thought, then obviously, yes, okay, because there is a passage that I can't remember where it's from. Sorry, brain. Pandemic brain. That's my excuse for everything these days.
Yeah, we all have it. Don't
exactly. That says that, you know, somebody pursuing virtue doesn't matter whether they're 1 centimeter beneath right. the sea or sort of 1 foot or 1 mile beneath the sea, they're still going to drown. Right. right. The idea that, you know, if you haven't come up into virtue, it makes no difference. And that's obviously an idea that sort of the early Stoics are much more hardcore kind of there is this side and there is that side and there is no middle right. ground.
But you know, even that I always found the drowning man metaphor interesting because you can take it in different ways. One way, you know, so one constructive way I guess you can take it is as just a reminder of about humility. Just don't go around thinking that you are wise and you are, you know, a sage and all that sort of stuff, my friend. You can drown even in a few centimeters of water. But you know, the Stoics themselves, even the early ones, describe themselves as those who make progress. And so, you know, as long as you make progress, it's, you know, that's what you're striving for. You don't necessarily, and also there are other traditions like Christianity or Buddhism, where it would be hard pressed. You would be hard pressed to say, well, I'm a failure because I'm not like Jesus or I'm a failure because I'm not Buddha. You know, that's sort of, well, wait a minute. Are you trying to do your best? Yes. Well, then, you know, then we'll see. Then we'll talk about it. But somehow when it comes to Stoicism, that notion is taken to be absolute and therefore a kind of off-putting. The notion of this age, I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that is, well, that's because of a centuries of tradition of reading in that way, isn't it? And sort of feeling that as a very, very rigid standard to which people are held. Whereas, and I think sort of cosmopolitanism probably suffers from a similar problem. And equally, the set of interpretations I sort of mentioned at the beginning that sort of see it as exclusively the inhabitant of the sage rather than sort of understanding city meaning the ancient city is very exclusionary. If you think that the only people who are entitled to this sort of community are those who are perfect, and we've already established that those who are perfect do not exist, or at least are extremely rare, that's not really an appealing model to be working with, I'll grant you that. Yeah. But when you sort of think about it in terms of aspiration, of the hortatory, the encouraging model, and when you think about it in terms of sort of the ancient concept of a city, then suddenly those kinds of objections of the, well, this just doesn't stand, this could never work, it's actually that isn't quite what's going on there.
I wonder if I could follow up just a touch on that. You know, the early Greek drowning man example and, you know, some other stuff that they say, and of course the rarity of the sage and so on. Do you think that Seneca abandons that view, or it's more of a question of a shift of emphasis?
I think it's the shift of emphasis. And I think this is sort of very much sort of a pattern in Roman Stoicism, certainly, which the argument is that Roman Stoicism becomes a lot more about practical application. Mm-hmm. Now, there are arguments about that. It's not that they're not doing sort of the physics and the logic. Of course, they're still doing the physics and the logic. It just so happens that their practical stuff has survived in extremely large amounts because it resonated. They nails heads and so forth, you know, and that sort of means that these things survive. Mm-hmm. And also sort of, as you say, Massimo, sort of in some ways morally mapped on quite nicely to some of sort of the moral stuff of Christianity. And therefore you end up sort of with people using Seneca and as a Christian model sort of during the Renaissance period, that kind of stuff, because of the resonance in ethics and that idea of self-improvement, particularly in the moral letters. But yeah, I think sort of what you kind of get in Seneca is that shift towards thinking about moral improvement as something that we're never going to make it to Sages. We know we're going to never get to it. But again, that image of the person who is making progress and using it in quite a strongly visual way, you know, I am further along the path than you are, he says to Lucilius in the Moral Letters. You know, I might be a bit further ahead of you, but I haven't got there yet, you know, and thinking about that journey metaphor and really taking that on board. I don't think they've sort of abandoned the fact that virtue is hard. And getting to sagehood is hard, not at all. But they are more hopeful, realistic, open to the fact that a life being led in the best, you know, fail better next time mode is, you know, is a life that's worth living and it's worth moving forward with, you know.
Great. There are some hints in what you say about brotherhood in the Ad Polybium, but as we get into some other sort of relationships, and especially as you get into the letters and so on in the book, there's an interesting relationship that sort of develops, I think, in the story you tell about what Seneca is bringing in a Stoic conception of familial relationships and the sort of traditional Roman conceptions that seems to sort of be highlighted, to my mind at most, in the relationship between fathers and sons, the pater familias picture that seems to be challenged quite a bit by Seneca's Stoicism. Am I getting that right? Or?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And this all comes down, there are some really interesting tensions between the Stoic model of the family and the ancient Roman model of the family. And to kind of get that, you have to understand how the Roman family is structured. So the Roman family, and this is in legal terms, this is in social terms, is centered around the figure of the pater familias, okay? Who is the eldest male in the family, might be your dad, might be your older brother, might be your granddad, might be an uncle, whoever happens to be in that position legally. And that person has got complete legal power over everybody who is in his familia, who's in that family grouping. And that is until that person dies. So you could be a 35-year-old man with a quite hale and hearty 70-year-old dad and not be legally able to act independently without his approval. Which is just worth noting. There are ways around this. You can be emancipated, so your father can decide to emancipate you. There is a fund of money you can have called a peculium, which is sort of a set of like pocket money almost that you're allowed to have of your own accord. But you're not allowed to sign legal deals. You're not allowed to make a will. You're not allowed to own property of your own. There is very little scope, unless you are emancipated, for doing stuff while you remain in the power of your pater familias. You can kind of see why this might lead to interfamilial conflict.
Yes.
There might be some challenges here, especially because of sort of depending on how strict a pater familias is, depending on how rigid they are. And Roman society basically has a massive complex about parricide precisely for this reason. Mm-hmm. And the threat, the fear is always, what about the son who in his young and debauched youth runs up ridiculous debts on girls and women and wine and ships that sink in sort of trying to do dodgy business deals or whatever, and then has no choice except to kill his father to get his inheritance to pay his debtors off. they worry about this. The Roman legal texts worry away at the possibility of the murderous son driven by financial problems. There are two sides to the coin. You have the incredibly strict paterfamilias. You have the totally indulgent, overdoing it paterfamilias who doesn't discipline his son and therefore also leads him into being a wastrel. It's not all about that, but one of the big worries is what happens to these boys, these young men, even these middle-aged men who do not have economic freedom and independence to act as independent agents. How common was this? this leads us into Latin demography, Roman demography. And do we have the numbers? Do we have the censuses? No. Again, another area where I envy my early modern colleagues who have this data sort of surviving. But it depends. If you sort of look at estimated, we kind of have to look at gravestones and tombstones and try and work out what we think is going on with the average age of death and that kind of stuff. But the sort of the thinking sort of goes that you're looking between possibly a third of Roman men having a surviving father to somewhere like a sixth or a seventh of having a surviving father at about, where's the figure, about 30 or 40. So either way, that's a lot of grown adult men who would probably like not to be under their father's control. So you know, you've kind of got that. That's the issue, right? You've got a legal system that's set up in such a way that there are real and lived consequences for these folks. And of course, obviously, this is going to apply more to elite houses where there is more money sloshing about, but also life expectancies are likely better because you can afford better food. Sure. And I don't know, medical care, that kind of stuff. Whereas lower down the food chain, lower down the class chain, rather, you might have sort of less high rates of paternal survival, but there's also less at stake because there's less money sloshing around. You know, you're not necessarily transacting a business deal in the same kind of way. So that's kind of the structure that this comes into. And let's just go back to oikeiosis a minute ago, right? Let's go back to oikeiosis, because oikeiosis is the key to understanding precisely why Seneca and how he approaches this stuff is totally different from this very hierarchical, top-down, paterfamilias at top, everyone else underneath structure. Oikeiosis says there's you in the middle, and then in that first circle outside, there is parents, both of them, siblings, any gender, spouse.
Right.
So those relationships are placed on exactly the same level. There is not one relationship that's hierarchized above all others. There's not one person or one particular link that's more important. They are all equally important in that circle to you as an individual.
Which is pretty radical.
Absolutely. Yeah. Hugely radical. Even today, you know, right. the kind of idea that you know, that your children and your partner and your parents have the same kind of relationship with you as each other, that there's kind of the same kind of nexus and angle, and you treat them with the same priority and the same respect, and you think about them in the same way, that kind of does one's head in a little bit, actually. And that's quite a big thing to get on board. What does that mean? Because obviously we have a lot of, even now, there's a lot of articulation about, well, you respect your parents, right? So, okay, so you respect your parents. You also respect your children. You know, and certainly when you kind of think about the rhetoric of what respect your parents means, and you think about that in terms of respect your children, suddenly, in a particular kind of discourse, obviously, suddenly those kinds of things in Stoicism, that changes a lot of hierarchical statements. But even more so in the Roman world, where the paterfamilias is top dog always, suddenly down off that pillar and placed on a par with his wife, your mother, or indeed might be your grandmother, who knows? Maybe the paterfamilias isn't even in that circle because he's a grandfather, which means he's a further circle out. So he's completely pushed out of this ring. You know, it's a very different set of dynamics that's brought in by the Stoic approach to family and the perceived structure of it.
Yeah, I think Rob has a follow-up. But in the meantime, I want to remind our people that this is probably the time to raise your little hand. I see one person is already has the hand up. So in a few minutes, we're going to get to Q&A. Rob, yes.
Yeah, so it seems to also follow from that account using the oikeiosis bit, right, that the paterfamilias, in fact, could become, if someone is particularly wise, very approaching sagehood down the journey quite a bit, could be no more or less important to such a person than, you know, the most remote Scythian, right?
Yeah, absolutely. There is absolutely nothing in Stoicism that prioritizes anybody.
Right.
I mean, the person who is prioritized, if anybody, is the person in the middle, the self.
Right, right.
But that's only because that's the person in who, you know, you have to sort of have a grip on yourself to work your relationships with other people, right? And that's the person, again, coming back to this, what Massimo was saying, this is the person you can control.
Right.
You can't control all those other folks.
Yeah, exactly.
But you can, you are in control of yourself and how you sort of view your relationships with these other people and thinking about them on that equal plane, and the plane equal with you. You're not better than them.
Right.
So whereas the hierarchy model is like, for want of a better word, like a Lego tower, the Stoic model is much more, you know, everyone's standing on the same plane. Everybody's sort of standing on an equal level with each other. And I cannot think of a good game to parallel that with. Chess, maybe. Everyone's like the same level on the chessboard.
Yeah. Okay, let's start with some of the questions. Ted is first in line. Ted, you can unmute yourself and ask your question.
Yes, thank you. So the generalization, or it seems to me that this idea of everybody being equal in that first circle, wouldn't that more be a generalization? I mean, in terms of particular families, wouldn't you think each individual might have a different relationship? We're all still human after all. I'm not going to follow a rule of that sort so closely, I wouldn't imagine.
No, it's not about saying that we have the same relationship with everybody, because obviously, for instance, the way that I interact with my five-year-old son is very different to the way I interact with my husband, for instance, for obvious reasons. One of them requires less help with sort of getting things off top shelves, for instance. It's not about saying that every relationship has to be exactly the same, but it's about sort of saying the way that you respect and you engage and you think about these people's interests as being the same as yours, and you sort of think about their proceeding to virtue, you know, it's on an equal. You don't prioritize one person above anybody else in that sense. You don't take one person's word as more important. Obviously, again, you know, were I, for instance, to ask the two people in my house with me at the moment, because we're on English lockdown, hooray, the best way to repair a broken cupboard, I'm probably going to sort of decide rationally that one's advice is probably better than the other's, given the experience that one of them has in mending things and that the other has in not mending things. But that's a rational decision that I'm taking based on the input that I'm given, rather than predetermining that I'm going to sort of say, well, I'm not going to even bother engaging with the five-year-old's attitude, because no, you know, it's not about standardizing relationships, but it's about hierarchy. That's the one.
Which is very different from other philosophies that, for other respects, have actually surprising similarities with Stoicism, such as Confucianism. In Confucianism, there is an explicit hierarchical structure, so that you are supposed to favor your parents and your siblings and all that over other people, to the point even that if your father does something, you know, unethical, you're supposed to actually shield him because he's your father. The Stoics have nothing of the sort. I mean, it doesn't matter, it's your father, it's a human being, and he's you know, as valuable or as good as any other human beings, at least except for the specifics that you were talking about. You know, the person happens to know how to fix things, then you ask him as opposed to somebody else. Terry, go ahead.
Thanks, Massimo. My question's about long-term pair bonding. And I know that the wise will marry and the wise will have children. And that's, of course, long-term pair bonding is quite popular now. So is this purely parochial to ourselves and to the Romans, or can it actually be derived in some way from, you know, Stoic principles?
I think it can be derived from Stoic principles because of the notion of stability and the importance of stability for our mental equilibrium. And one of the things Stoic Seneca says, actually, in his On Marriage, we only have fragments of it, they come through St. Jerome, which is a whole other story, which I shall not get into because I get cross about it in a useful and productive way. But we can sort of say that there are some things in there that sort of are, if not directly quoted from Seneca, then pretty clearly sort of either paraphrasing or engaging with. And one of the things he sort of really critiques is people who get married one day and get divorced the next day, or get divorced and get remarried and really, really quickly. And one of the reasons for that, obviously, first of all, if you're making decisions like that, that doesn't really sort of indicate a very rational, grounded approach to these sorts of things, and that might be something we might be concerned about. But it also reflects a lot of change and a lot of disruption. And one of the things that the Stoics are really sort of keen on is equanimity, is on stability and having stability. You know, your stability is what sort of enables you to cope with the instability of the outside world, right? You know, the fact that you are stable lets you cope with the instability of fortune. So if you are randomly introducing extra instability into your life the Romans are way up there, particularly the Romans of Seneca's class, for divorce, remarriage, you know, complex networked nested families where, you know, you might have relations across whole different clans because of your father's three or four marriages over a period of time for political and different kinds of means, right? But instead, Seneca does really talk about family as if, you know, he is not a big fan of divorce. He doesn't say anything negatively, I think, about remarrying after, after bereavement. That he doesn't sort of pick up on. And he also talks about divorce in a very specific set of contexts, and the kind of contexts he talks about them are basically where you're divorcing person A to go and marry person B because you already committed adultery with them. Mm-hmm. And that is kind of not really a good move, because what's going to stop that happening again? And then you'll move on to the next, you know, that perhaps you might want to really just examine your irrational passions there, and passion being the key word, sort of part of all of that. But I think in terms of sort of the long-term stability that sort of a long-term marriage or a long-term relationship has, it's coming out of that idea of rationally making a rational choice to sort of spend one's life with somebody on the grounds that this is going to be the most beneficial outcome for both partners in a long-term stable kind of way.
I see that Ted has probably a follow-up question, so go ahead.
I did, thank you, Massimo. On the issue of moving out of the household, where you mentioned the father or the oldest male has the control, what happens upon marriage?
No, nothing. Now, it depends whether you're a man or a woman. Important point. If you're a man, you stay under your father's control. You're still under your father's control until he formally decides to legally emancipate you. And that is a formal legal thing that he has to do, whether you're married or not. If you're a woman, it depends on what way you get married, because the Romans are great. There are two kinds of marriage in ancient Rome, okay? You have marriage that's called cum manu, or with manus marriage, and marriage that is sine manu, without manus. Manus is the Roman word for hand. And that basically, a cum mano marriage is a particular kind of marriage ceremony. And the most significant point of it for this is that the woman becomes a member of her new husband's familia. Okay. Remember, the familia is the group of people that is under a part of familius's control. So if you marry with manus as a woman, you stop being under your part of familius's control and become under your husband's paterfamilias's control, which could be him, his dad, his granddad, his uncle. New random male in charge of your life legally, and you are treated exactly like a member of the familia. There is no distinction at all. You've been grafted across. If you get married sine manu, without marriage, you stay in your own familia. You stay under your father, your paterfamilias's control. And where that gets really interesting, that there are reasons for getting married sine manu. They're mainly about property, because obviously if there's a lot of dowry, if there's a lot of money involved, you don't necessarily want all of that going into somebody else's familia.
Right.
So we'll just keep that under the economic control of the paterfamilias. The other really weird, interesting thing about is if you don't get married, cum manu, if you're married without manus, any children you have with your husband belong to his familia. So it is perfectly possible and perfectly common for a mother to belong to one familia and her children and her husband to belong to another.
Interesting.
And there is absolutely no legal connection about them between them at all.
Wow.
She has absolutely no right to them because they are completely under the part of familia's control.
Liz, we have a few minutes, but I wanted to ask you, going back to Seneca, in the book, you write that Seneca is a more radical and original thinker than it's usually given credit for. What do you mean? In what sense?
I mean, this is kind of, in some ways, actually, that's a very 2017 statement, she says. and indeed is also sort of indicative of when this book was being written, because as some of you will know, this sort of came out of my PhD research, and this is the result of, I mean, this is a book that was worked on for nearly 10 years. And in some ways, it shows that. And that statement is one of them. Because when I sort of first started engaging with Seneca, there was a lot of feeling in the scholarship that he was very derivative and he was very boring and he wasn't sort of necessarily doing anything terribly interesting. And it was all sort of essentially either parroting ancient sort. And that was one side of it. And the other side of it was the argument that he wasn't a Seneca at all, a Stoic at all, rather. And this charge of eclecticism, which totally misunderstands sort of Roman literary culture, which is all about showing how learned you are and being able to interact with other kinds of thought and other writers and intertext and all of that kind of stuff, which was picked up and read as he's an eclectic thinker, he isn't actually a Stoic. Now, thankfully, since I was sort of first coming to terms and getting hold of the bibliography, things have come on leaps and bounds, and people are now a lot better at actually seeing where Seneca is innovating and where Seneca is sort of offering unique things. And I think that also comes from the fact that in terms of sort of Stoicism, studies of academic studies of Stoicism itself, we have become a lot more comfortable with the idea that the Stoics take the view that while there are Stoic teachings and Stoic leaders, that ultimately you as an individual are responsible for parsing Stoicism and working it out and making the applications in your own life. So Seneca, what can be seen as people who are terribly concerned about tradition get quite upset about and sort of say, well, Seneca went off there and nobody else followed him. The Stoics are sort of quite comfortable to say, yeah, that's because that was him doing his thing and we're all now doing our thing. But that's part of the conversation. That's part of the ongoing conversation of doing the philosophy and working it out. And just because we haven't gone off there, that doesn't matter. That doesn't make his Stoicism any less valuable. Hello, Anne, small person. Very nice to see you. Hello. But yes, so I think that aspect of being much more comfortable with sort of the way that sort of Stoicism encourages the individual to work through their own moral questionings and make their own intellectual mark on Stoicism actually has sort of meant that when Seneca does innovate and does apply and does come up with sort of new angles on things, we're now much less likely to see that as somehow a negative quality in him. Whereas certainly 15 years ago, that was still sort of rather contentious ground, I think.
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite bits in the letters is when he says to Lucilius, you know, the people that preceded us are not our masters, they're just our teachers. And if we find out something new and discover something new and take a new path, then it's fine. I would put in modern terms, this is not a religion. Zeno and Chrysippus are not scripture. You can disagree with them and do things differently. That does not make you non-Stoic. It just makes you somebody who thinks on their own. So I think Rob has one more question. But
yeah, I did. Yeah,
go ahead.
I just wanted to pick your brain a little bit, Liz, while we have you, and maybe you can help Massimo and I with our homework. As he mentioned at the very beginning, in a couple of weeks on Valentine's Day, we're going to be talking about love and Stoicism. And I wondered if you had, off the top of your head, any idea of any text that we would be horribly remiss for not considering on that topic.
Blimey, that's a good
question. sorry to
No, it's all right. I mean, well, as you know, there isn't a bit of there is a bit in the book that is about amor, and sort of amor is a stoic. Yeah, there are problems with sort of amor and when it's being used to refer to a passion and when it's being used to refer to an emotion, and is it irrational or what is going on there? Basically, the Stoics do think you can have amor. You've just got to be careful that it's rational amor and not irrational amor. But I mean, I think actually where it might be quite interesting to... might be quite interesting in a kind of slightly left field way to have a look at Seneca's Phaedra. Which now obviously there's a big debate about how much Seneca's stoicism influences his plays. Yep. Now they are not straightforward dramatizings of Stoic theory. They're not meant to convince people to come over to the Stoic side. They're not meant to be, you know, deeply convincing. But I think the position I'm sort of at now, in the kind of this is the next big book as and when I get around to it kind of way, is that they are working out ideas in the Stoic universe, but they're working them out in with messy, confused, muddled people, which, let's face it, is what most of us are. And they sort of danger test these, destruct test, that's the word I'm after. They test these ideas to destruction and see what happens when people make some really, really bad decisions. And Seneca's Phaedra, of course, is a riff on Euripides' Hippolytus, right, which is all about the ancient mythic character Hippolytus, who is accused. Phaedra is married to Theseus, and he has Hippolytus by a first wife. And unfortunately, Phaedra, the stepmother, falls in love with her stepson. And while Theseus is away, sort of propositions him, and he basically goes and runs 100 miles because he's dedicated to Diana, the goddess of virginity and chastity. And she is so unimpressed with this that she accuses him of raping her. And when Theseus comes back and finds her either having killed herself or alternatively sort of making the accusation, depending on which variant you're in, Theseus brings down the curse from his father Poseidon and has his son killed, only of course for it to be revealed that this was her, because this was a false accusation because of her love for her stepson. So as a story in which he unpicks amor gone wrong and passion gone wrong, I mean, I think that might be an interesting place to go.
Thank you. Well, I for one, I would look very much forward to a book on Stoicism in Seneca's plays. I mean, that ought to be interesting. And I, as far as I know, nobody's ever touched that aspect of it.
Oh, well, there's quite a lot on Stoicism in the plays, but it takes quite a limited view. And the more I'm working on it, the more I'm sort of thinking, I'm really interested in ideas of the family and the play and the house relationships and how Stoic ideas influence that kind of stuff and how this all comes together. It's bubbling. Very, very slowly, along with everything else in my copious free time.
Yeah, I know the feeling. All right. Well, we've done basically an hour, so I know that there are people, unfortunately, wanting to ask questions, but we're running out of time. And I'd like to thank Liz Gloin for joining us today. Her book on Seneca and the family, I agree with Rob, is one of my favorite books at this point, not only about Seneca, but about sort of Stoicism in general. So thank you for taking the time to be with us today, Liz.
Yeah, absolutely. I second that. Yeah,
great, thank you all. Great, it's conversation. Been fun.
Yeah.
And then Rob, we'll see you on February 14th at 1 p.m. Eastern time to talk about love. And until then, stay safe.